Well, Chijioke is going to read to us this morning from Micah, chapter 4, and the first four verses.
Our reading this morning is taken from Micah, chapter 4, verse 1 to 4, some page 932 of the Church Bible. In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as chief among the mountains. It will be raised above the hills, and people will stream to it. Many nations will come and say, "Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the Lord of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, so that we may walk in his paths." The Lord will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge between many peoples and will settle disputes for strong nations far and wide. They will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations will not take up swords against nation, nor will they train for war anymore. Every man will sit under his own vine and under his own fig tree, and no one will make them afraid, for the Lord Almighty has spoken. This is the word of God.
Well, please turn, if you will, to the passage that Chijioke read a while ago, Micah chapter 4, and if you've got one of the church Bibles, it's on page 932. If you don't have one of the church Bibles, use the index to find Micah again if you didn't place a marker, because these minor prophets have a habit of disappearing. And when you think you know where they are, they go and rearrange themselves and fool you. And there you are, trying to find Micah for most of the sermon. And the person next to you is watching you do this and realizes that you don't know where Micah is. So you might not be a very good Christian. Now, I want to do three things. I want to look at what's actually there in the text, what's written on the page. And then I want to look at the way in which the first four verses end. And then I want to look at how that relates to ourselves nowadays in the church. To get the enormity of what Micah prophesies from God, what God says through Micah in these first little bits of chapter 4, which marks a change in the prophecy. And from 4:1 onwards, there are five sort of salvation oracles, five little passages which speak of God's great saving and delivering work. And this is the first of them. And to get how amazing they are, we need to just recall or sort of take on board that the end of chapter 3 leaves Jerusalem, not just the city, but its temple, the very core of the people's identity, because that's where they met with Jehovah. The very core of God's presence amongst them. The thing that was most dear to them, the thing that signaled not simply their identity nor their strength, but the power of God in their midst. Jerusalem and its temple were ruined. Micah was prophesying about the time when the Babylonians would come in, they would lay siege to all the surrounding countryside, and they would eventually take Jerusalem and desecrate its temple. And that was coming because the people themselves had turned away from God. Their leaders and kings, their prophets and priests, and all the people had repeatedly turned their back on God. And so within God's own people, two things are highlighted. There is a despising of justice, and there is bloodshed. So there are the two things that we often associate most with war, when unjust, terrible things happen, when the truth becomes the first casualty, and when bloodshed characterizes human relationships. Now, God's people had always faced that from others. Whether that was the Egyptians before the Exodus, whether it was those who attacked them during the Exodus, whether it was those who fought with them in the land when they were taking it, whether it was Philistines later on for a long, long time, whether it was Syrians or Assyrians or Babylonians or whoever. They had always faced injustice and the threat of bloodshed. But what God, through Micah, has put his finger on is that the very things that previously they had been facing from others are actually found within the walls of the city, the holy city, the place where God had made his name to dwell. And so disaster is going to come upon them, and they will suffer at the hands of others what they have been doing amongst themselves. They will suffer injustice and bloodshed. And so chapter 3 ends with this sort of devastating picture. We've seen pictures of devastated landscapes and blasted buildings, many of which have been rebuilt. We saw there the famous wool hall in Ypres, which is rebuilt as in all its original magnificence. You would never know, never dream that it had been rubble before. Well, Chapter 3, verse 12, gives us a picture of the rubble. Therefore, because of you, that is, because of the kings and leaders and the priests and prophets and that filtering down to all the people, because of you, Zion will be plowed like a field, Jerusalem will become a heap of rubble, the temple hill a mound overgrown with thickets. That's what the people's own sin would do to them in the hands of a holy God. But that's not the end. Because then chapters 4 and 5 and on bring us these five oracles of future days. We have in the NIV, at the beginning of chapter 4, verse 1, in the last days. Now, that may catapult some of us into thinking about the last days and what we call eschatology and the Lord's coming, and will there be a tribulation before, after it, or isn't there going to be one, or whatever. And we get all, you know, kind of, we immediately click into that, which is not so helpful when we're approaching the text here, because the phrase, in the last days, which can trigger all those thoughts and doctrines and teachings and everything, is really not helpfully translated at that point. And one or two other versions have a better translation, which is simply in the coming days, because it's not tied to one period as such. It has sort of pre-echoes, and it sort of filters through different periods of time. And so simply if we take it as it is in the Hebrew, in the coming days, we're likely to have a clearer picture of how we fit in with chapter 4, verses 1 following. So, in the coming days. Now, what we have, we're just going to do a little bit of close study of the text in this first part when we're looking at what it says. The next words are, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as chief among the mountains. It will be raised above the hills and people will stream to it. Now, what we might miss there is that in the Hebrew, there is a little link between 3:12 and 4:1, because what we have as the temple hill, in Hebrew the word ha, the temple hill, is the word that God uses through Micah when he talks about in 4:1, the ha, the mountain of the Lord's temple, will be established as chief amongst all mountains. So, 3:12, absolute ruin and rubble, destroyed. The temple in Jerusalem, Jerusalem itself looking like something from an old black and white photo of some Belgian town or some northern French town with a few troops marching through the remnants. That kind of picture. And then 4:1, exactly the same place, but glorious and beautiful, rebuilt with even greater splendor and populated entirely differently. Now, that's the first thing, that what was destroyed, the temple hill, becomes a beautiful, wonderful, established place again in the coming days. But the other thing for us to just bear in mind is what this phrase mountain, or what that term mountain actually means in the language of the prophecy. Because a mountain is not simply what we might think of. You know, this isn't like a Monroe or something like that. This isn't like the fells in the Lake District. This isn't like mountains. You've got pictures of the Eiger or whatever in your mind, or Everest or something like that, or Sculpey. This is picture language. Because actually, if you were to stand there on the Temple Mount, you wouldn't be thinking of it as a mountain. If you've got mountains, you know, snow-capped ranges and all that kind of thing in your mind, if the word mountain means something like a Monroe, then you wouldn't be thinking of the temple in Jerusalem as, you wouldn't be thinking you were standing on the top of a mountain. You don't need breathing gear. You don't have to wear a down-fill jacket. It's very warm. It's not all that high either, really. Not all that high. And there are other hills around it that are bigger. Mountain isn't just a reference to, you know, height above sea level. Mountain is an elevated place because it is a place of power. It is a place of influence. It's a place down from which flow, not simply, you know, glacial meltwaters and rivers and all that kind of thing, but down from which flow laws and precepts, control, influence, leadership, government. See, the mountains are peaks of power. So 3:12 doesn't just simply paint for us a picture of a devastated city and a devastated temple. It paints for us a picture of the people's power and influence utterly broken. So the leaders who have been leading and reigning unjustly are broken in that. And the bloodshed that has been the consequence of what has been flowing down from the mountain, the bloodshed is a sign of that influence which leads to a disordered, fragmented, murderous society and violent city. And the temple is in rubble. Because as will emerge through other prophets, like his first three verses are paralleled in Isaiah chapter 2, for instance, or in prophets like Ezekiel, the prophets of the exile, God himself will not be there. He will not inhabit a temple which is on that kind of mountain. Unjust, violent, untruthful. He will not inhabit it. He will leave. And that's what we get in Ezekiel. We get this picture of God rising and going to the threshold and then leaving. He can't abide to be there. So 3:12 leaves us with not simply the city devastated after the Babylonians have come, the temple broken down and ruined, all its temple goods gone, and serving in the Babylonians' temple to their god Bel in Babylon. It is a picture of a broken place of power. It is a picture of the rubble of human power and influence when it departs from God. That's where 3:12 leaves us. And then 4:1 picks up and says, in the coming days, what will happen? God will not simply have you coming back in and rebuilding the physical walls and rebuilding the physical temple. He will come to it again. And he will return to his temple. And in future days, it will really be the mountain, picture language, the mountain that it was meant to be. It will become a place where God's power and God's reign will be. It will be the place from which stream down to all the people all the virtues of God the King, all his power, all his influence, all his governing of things. So where these earthly leaders had ruined the mountain, God will establish it again and raise it up, because he will reign, and he will reign with justice, he will reign with truth and righteousness, he will reign with glory. His kingdom, his kingship, will raise that mountain above every other mountain, so that he, as the king, in all the figurative language, in Jerusalem, on the hill, on the temple hill, he reigning will establish an entirely different kingdom. Now, that's the sort of the movement from 3:12 into chapter 4. That's what God is saying. There will come a time in the coming days when he will establish his kingship, and he will reign in an entirely different way, and he will be honored not just by his own people, but by all nations. And that's how the language develops. So we have the contrast between 3:12 and 4:1. What happens then? Well, it will be raised above the hills, so his kingship will be raised above every other kingship. You get the picture. You see how it works now, I hope. His sovereignty will be raised above every other sovereignty. He will be, if we put it like this, King of Kings and Lord of Lords, Revelation 19. And from him will flow something which will not simply be above all the other kingships and all the other nations and everything else around. It will attract them. So we have, it will be raised above the hills, and peoples, plural. Not just people like the Israelites, but peoples, plural. That is, ethnic groups, peoples, will stream to it. Now, we would miss the illusion that God is making there through Micah. But if we were hearing it from Micah, we probably would not miss the illusion, because we would be a bit more familiar with Jeremiah 51:44. Well, if we were hearing it in what was the finally compiled Hebrew scriptures. So many who were using the Hebrew scriptures in their compiled state would recognize, and it would become something that would connect with what Jeremiah was saying. Because Jeremiah 51:44 has a vision of nations streaming, but streaming where? Streaming to the temple of Bel, the Babylonian god, in Babylon. The god of the people, one of the chief gods of the people, who were doing all the destruction. So, what is it saying? It's saying God wins. God wins. And instead of people streaming to all these other gods and streaming to the powerful places of the nations, no, the flow will be reversed. And peoples will be streaming to God's place, to God himself as king, to God himself as governor. So peoples will stream to it. Put the emphasis on the word it. That is the mountain of the Lord's temple. Many nations will come and say, and then there follows a phrase which would have been familiar to every Jewish reader of the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures, and to those who are hearing Micah. It will be a phrase that will be familiar from the Psalms. It expresses an idea that is encapsulated in a whole string of Psalms called the Psalms of Ascents. Not now just God's people, not now just faithful Israelites, but now many nations will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. So in the coming days, God the King will attract peoples and many nations to himself. Up to himself. And what are they attracted by? What are they going to go there for? He will teach us his ways so that we may walk in his paths. They want that governance. They want that influence. They want that leadership. They want that kingship that flows from God's King, God's anointed one, God's Messiah, the Christ. They want to know his ways so that they can walk in his paths, walk in his ways. They don't just want to know it so they can discuss it. They don't just want to know it so they can pat themselves on the back and say how clever they are because of how much they know. They want to do it. They want to walk it. So people from many, many nations will want, as we might say, to walk God's talk and not their own. So the law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge between many peoples and will settle dispute for strong nations far and wide. And so an entirely new situation will obtain. See, previously people have been settling their own disputes. And people have been judging each other. And people have been doing it with injustice and with violence and with bloodshed. Which is what we live amongst, isn't it? When the nations, the leaders of the nations, are left to make judgment between one another and have to settle disputes for strong nations far and wide, what we get are trenches and mud and blood and blasted bodies and buildings. We get the landscape of the Somme, of Ypres. We get the horror and the sounds and the smells of Passchendaele. We get the gas, the bullets, the shells, the maiming. We get wave upon wave, thousands upon thousands, running at barbed wire, running at the bullets. We get whole towns where the pals all fell together. We get widows and orphans. We get amputees, IEDs. We get brilliant courage. We get outstanding compassion. We get phenomenally hard work. We get incredible loyalty and comradeship. We get fantastic ingenuity. But all that is to get us through horror. But when God reigns and people are learning from him and he is sovereign, then peoples will not settle the disputes themselves. Because he will judge many peoples and he will settle disputes for strong nations far and wide. And lo and behold, the people will discover that they don't need swords anymore. And they don't need spears anymore. They can do the farming in peace. And so what was used to kill is now used to reap a harvest and to feed the kids. So no longer will nation need to take up sword against nation. No longer will we need to train young men for war, young women for war. No longer will we have child soldiers. Instead of that, every man will sit under his own vine and under his own fig tree. And I'm sure that many of us here today have longed to live under our own vine and our own fig tree. And no one will make them afraid. Why? Because Jehovah Almighty has spoken. So that's what it says, and that last little verse there takes us to the second thing, which is to say that it will happen. When God sort of says there in verse 4 through Micah, "For the Lord Almighty has spoken," what's he saying? Well, A, Jehovah, the covenant-keeping God, has spoken, and what has been described, which we learn elsewhere from prophets like Jeremiah and Ezekiel, are the days of God's new covenant. That covenant is it's a done deal. And nobody can undo that covenant. Nobody can undo that great sovereignty because he is the Lord Almighty, the Lord of hosts. He commands everything to serve his purposes. And so it's going to happen, you see. He has spoken. And we should not take Micah 4, 1 to 4 as being the kind of idealistic utopian Shangri-La dream that cannot stand in the face of the reality of international warfare. We shouldn't see it like that. We shouldn't see it as some sort of old, haunting, but forlorn hope, divorced from reality. We shouldn't see it as something which requires everybody suddenly to become good and we know they're not going to. It is the word of the Lord Almighty. He has spoken. It will happen. Not because our politicians make it happen. Not because our leaders make it happen. Not because our economists make it happen. But because God will put his king upon the throne. What makes his mountain higher than any other is his king, which is why we began with Psalm 2. Jesus Christ reigns. And that's why Micah 4, 1 to 4 is not a forlorn dream of a hopeless optimist. Jesus Christ reigns. Now the third thing, and this is where we come in, is a sign that it is not a forlorn hope of an old dreamer. Because what has happened, and this is why we cannot defer it until a last day, but take seriously the Hebrew, which simply says in the coming days. Well, you see, this king who reigns has already started Micah 4, 1 to 4. It's already begun. It's not the hope of something that might suddenly come into being later on, at some distant time. Which, you know, given our leaders internationally, we would say would never happen. It's something that comes from Jesus and it's already started. Where is the evidence that it's already started? Where's the evidence? Well, look around you. You are the evidence that this has already started. We are the evidence. The church is the beginning of this. So what do we find in the church? We find that Jesus Christ as King is our highest authority. And we recognize others, but Jesus is above them all. So that we obey him at all cost. And we find that the word has come to us from Zion, from Jerusalem, that from his throne, his word comes to us and shapes us. The law has gone out. The word of the Lord has come to us. And we find in our own hearts this desire that is expressed there, that he will teach us his ways so that we might walk in his paths. So when we learn from Jesus, we don't just do it to say, well, that's really interesting, and that's one point of view. And we don't do it to say, you know, how clever we are because of how much we know. We do it, we learn from him, so that we might actually walk his talk. And look around you today. Many nations gathered under his kingship. Many people saying, let's go and worship Jesus. So here today we are an international community. And did we get this way because we managed somehow or another to spill blood and do injustice and win. No church is free of its conflicts. But we don't kill each other. Normally. There is no bloodshed. We do not take up the weapons of this world. Remember Jesus saying to Peter in the garden, those who live by the sword will die by the sword. He did not want a sword amongst his followers. Every man will sit under his vine and under his own fig tree. It's a picture of peace that comes from God. Safety that comes from him. So that even when there are things that might be fearful, we do not live in fear, but in peace. Peace I give to you, said Jesus. My peace I give to you. Not as the world gives, do I give to you. We are the evidence of what one day will be seen globally. We and every other gathering like us in a church building or out in the open or in someone's home or wherever it happens, in war-blasted Iraq, in church-persecuted northern Nigeria, in Syria, in any part of the world, the Church of Jesus Christ is the living evidence of the sovereignty of Jesus Christ. Which is why I prayed at the very beginning that we might remember in order to learn, that we might look back in order to look ahead differently. You see, what we are as a Christian church is we are a signpost to the future because we point back to that great sacrifice on the cross. As we remember today, as we remember war, as we remember its horrors, as we remember what human beings do to one another when we govern each other, what we then do with all that, what we do with the last century's pictures of Micah 3:12, is we say, our challenge is to be that community of what God will do. To be now harbingers of what is to come. To learn so that we might walk. To leave judgment to God and not take it up ourselves. To enjoy his peace. And to show the nations that are gathered here in Aberdeen, to show the peoples amongst whom God will scatter us, that God is not a nice idea, but is the sovereign, the Prince of Peace, the King of Kings, and Lord of Lords. And we show it